take roll call just by
starting with the screen and the others.
Yeah, taking it by the screen. Who's taking roll call? Laura.
All right. I am taking roll call.
Can we omit it and you can just take it by seeing who's on the screen?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, that's great. And if there's any question on the phone numbers, we can probably answer that separately.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, so I would ask if there's any public comment at this time. Any public comment? Seeing none, I will ask for an approval of the minutes for the November 18th, 2020 meeting.
John Coleman, move approval.
Second.
Chip Beckett, moved by John Coleman, seconded by Chip Beckett. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm assuming there was no corrections or adjustments. You're in your handouts. There's a series of correspondence and handouts, most specifically regarding the COGS summary of the county equivalents for the census boundaries. Lyle, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Very quickly, the Federal Register has a publication that will allow Connecticut to use the Council of Governments boundaries for the purposes of census. And this is helpful so that we can actually have data based on the planning region who use in the state rather than having them on the historic counties and then have to turn them into Council of Government boundaries. So that's what that is. There may be some money available at some point if it's written into the federal funding bills that will allow COGS to receive money for counties. And we will see if that happens. But the upshot of this is it won't happen until 2023. And it's mostly right now for census. So this doesn't create counties, it doesn't do anything else. It just creates the census boundaries for data as the 9 council of government boundaries in the state. And as I say, it's going to the Federal Register for comments, so it's not final, but once it's finalized, it will kick in the 2023, so it's a while. So that's what it is, Madam Chair. I don't know if any questions on it.
Any questions for Lyle in regards to it? If not, Lyle, do you want to talk briefly about the EDA?
Sure. We got a denial letter from EDA for the almost $10 million grant that Krog and others put together, and I want to thank Pauline and Tim Malone for a lot of work on that. We were very surprised to get a flat denial. We were expecting either acceptance or some lower number, we were kind of surprised. And as I was mentioning to the chair before the meeting, Connecticut had 4 grants at EDA in the last month. All were denied. Zero for 4. We have our own ideas of why that might happen. So where we are on this right now is that Mary Glassman, formerly of our board here in Simsbury, is the governor's COVID lead with the Economic Development Commissioner David Layman are coming up with a plan for resubmission of a grant at a lower level. And when we have information on that, we will certainly share. But Krog was really the sort of organizing administrative body, but we don't really have the authority to determine what the grant will be and who will get it, the apportionment. So where that is right now is that Mary Glassman in the governor's office, plus David Layman in the Economic Development Department are coming up with a plan. They are communicating with EDA National on the scale and scope of a revised grant. The second part of that is reaching out when we find out who the new Commerce Commissioner is, as EDA falls under the United States Department of Commerce, and try to smooth the way for a subsequent grant going forward. The incoming administration is going to be interested in supporting state and local governments as well as the efforts we're talking about here. So there's 2 prongs. One is resubmitting the grant at some reduced level, with a different kind of content, and then smoothing the way once we figure out who the Commerce Secretary is at the federal level for that grant. As I say, we're very disappointed, but we're putting one foot in front of the other, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, it would be interesting to see if you respond and rewrite the areas that they noted where they thought there was duplication and how you would continue to have sustainability, and also what outcomes you hope to achieve to identify those in a new submission.
Right. Well, the problem, Madam Chair, is the 8 points that were cited in the letter were actually addressed by us. We were encouraged to do a statewide application. by the regional EDA rep and then got dinged for doing a statewide application. We responded to those 8 points in direct response to what the EDA regional person said. So that's why we were surprised. These were handled. So we'll have to get a bit more clarity on the level of funding that would be acceptable and on the, as you say, getting much more clarity on the bullet points. So there's a combination of a request for a debriefing and then also the intel on whether a resubmission at a reduced level would be granted. But we take exception to the fact that these bullet points were cited in a rejection letter because Tim Malone spent a lot of time on responding to those with the specific guidance of the EDA office in Philadelphia. So that's sort of where we are on that.
All right, do you have anything else to share, Lyle?
Just one more thing I wanted to bring up at this point, and that is to recognize Winsome for her 47 years at CROG. She started as a child, but we want to thank Winsome for the end of the year for her 47 years of clean audits and very diligent work on our behalf. And we just nailed down the audit for this year. But it's not very often, and we want to thank Winsome for this, for diligent and excellent work over that really long period of time. So we certainly want to recognize Winsome for that tremendous achievement. So I don't know if you want to say a word, Winsome, but...
We should clap for her. No, that's it. That's better.
Well, it's been a pleasure working with you all over the years. I know I've been saying for years that I'm retiring this year, but I think COVID kind of proved to me that I can be at home and not be thinking about what am I going to do if I'm at home. So I think this kind of brought it together for me. So it's been a pleasure. And I told Lyle I will continue in a consulting mode until we do the transition. So I'll be around for a little bit. Going forward, I don't know for how long, but will be as needed.
Yep. So we need to get the audit to the Personnel Finance Committee and then the transition.
Right.
Obviously, with 47 years of experience, you have a lot to transmit. So we'll look forward to working with on that.
And the audit was submitted today online by the auditors. It's been certified. So they should be delivering copies to the office, usually by FedEx. And they'll email me the letter to the audit committee. So I'll send that out as soon as I get it. And again, it's been a long ride, but I think it's time.
Again, thank you so much, Winsome.
Thank you, Winsome, for all of your work and your commitment.
You're welcome.
Wonderful. And I'm sorry we're not able to be together to celebrate your send-off.
We're all losing weight at CROG because we have no going-away cakes.
Well, not on this end, I can tell you. The next order of business to come before us is the... subcommittee reports, and for those, there were summaries placed in all of your packets. Does anyone have any questions in regards to the deadlines from the information that was provided in regards to municipal services and the purchasing council or the policy and planning, public safety and homeland security, or the transportation committee? Any questions? If anyone hasn't had the time to review them and wants to do it afterward, certainly can send questions to the respective committee representative at CROG, and they'll be happy to answer them. We're going to actually take an opportunity to skip over the presentation at this time because we have to have a quorum for all of our action committee action items today. So. For the purposes of a motion, I'm going to, for the 2021 CROG legislative agenda, I'm going to recognize Chris Kerbin, the chair of that committee, to talk a little bit about the legislative agenda that he's mapped out with his committee. Chris?
Thank you. I had to unmute. Thank you, Madam Chair. I Just want to say briefly that the information we have is that they're planning a relatively tight legislative session this year. So we wanted to respond to that by preparing and submitting a document that that was somewhat narrowly tailored and narrow our presentation to just a few broad categories. We also wanted to bring COVID recovery to the forefront and sort of highlight that as our most important topic and request. And so several of the items fall under that initial category. We wanted to avoid duplication of items that have been sought by other organizations such as CCM to the extent possible. And so the document that has been provided, we think, does that. I want to thank the members of the legislative committee for their work in getting together to fashion this document. I wanted to especially thank Dr. Lyle Ray for his insight. With that, I would move for the adoption of the draft legislative agenda by the policy board. And if seconded, if there's any specific questions or comments, they can be addressed at that time.
I'd second that, John Coleman.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Questions for Chris in regards to the legislative agenda?
Awesome.
Seeing none, we'll move right along.
Madam Chair, just as an FYI, we will be working with Kathy Lutz to set up Zoom meetings with appropriate legislative leaders to follow up on the agenda. So we'll proceed apace.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next item up for action is a resolution authorizing the EZIQC regional contractor awards. For the purposes of a motion, I recognize Kim Bona.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. In October, CROG went out to bid for indefinite quantity construction services for both bridge and road maintenance, as well as general construction services. In November, bids were opened and have since been reviewed. Recommendations have been made by CROG's consultant, and low bidders have been selected. That said, in front of you today, there are two resolutions. And the first resolution is to award contracts for bridge and road maintenance to low bidders as follows: Lavero Construction, Suchaki Construction, Hemlock, and BMP Construction. Second resolution is to award contracts for general construction services to the lowest bidders, which are Millennium Builders and BMP Construction, as they came in significantly lower than the next lowest responsible bidder. So today we are seeking approval from the board on the two resolutions as presented.
Seth Gerbic, move the adoption of both.
Second, John Coleman.
Any discussion? I'll make a motion to approve the resolutions awarding the appropriate contractors for both the regional contract awards and the road and bridge maintenance. If there's no questions, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None, and the motion carries. Thank you. Thanks, Kim. Thank you. The next action item before us is a resolution authorized. Oh, no, we already did that one too. Do we want to take those up separately, even though we said it to combine it when they're separate?
We can reflect them in the minutes as it is. That's fine.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. The next item for action is a TIP amendment. For that purpose, I recognize John Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. There are no TIP amendments this time around. We do have two other items that the Transportation Committee has forwarded on to the policy board. One is item number 11, the performance measure safety targets, which is an annual process that the state goes through. This time the safety targets are a little more aggressive than in the past, which the Transportation Committee was pleased to see, and the Transportation Committee has reviewed these targets, has endorsed these targets, and recommends same to the policy board, and I would so move.
Motion made by John Coleman. Second?
Second. Chip Beckett.
Any discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. The next item up is the approval of the Regional Transportation Safety Plan.
Yes,
for that purpose, John Coleman.
This, thank you, Madam Mayor. This is a 5-year annual plan, and this is the beginning of the next 5 years. It's a data-driven plan that the feds require the state to do, and in turn, they require the regions to do on a regional basis. The Transportation Committee has reviewed the plan has approved the plan and recommends the same to the policy board, and I would so move.
Second.
Moved by John Coleman, seconded by Chip Beckett. Any questions in regards to the resolution? Seeing none, we'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any no nays? Motion carries. Thank you. So now we'll move back up to presentation. And I'm not sure if Representative Stastrom is on the call. I don't see him in my galley view.
I'm here.
I've seen Kim is nodding. Oh, there he is. Thank you. So we're really delighted to have Representative Steve Stastrom with us to talk a little bit about the police accountability bill. I know there was some discussions about some tweaks to the bill that was passed in the last legislative session that I'm certainly he can highlight for us as to what those are and to give us just an update on where he is. So we appreciate you making time for us, Steve, and we know how busy things are today. Even though we're not moving, we're sitting and still and we're keeping busy for sure. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, and thank you, Mayor LeClaire, and for getting Majority Leader Rojas to get me on the call, and happy to be here. So I don't necessarily have anything planned. I can certainly run through kind of some of the highlights of the bill and process from June if that's helpful to folks, but you may already know that may be rehash, and I can certainly talk about kind of what the lay of the land looks like as we go into session in January. So I guess, Mayor, what do you think would be most helpful to this group? I don't want to waste time rehashing stuff folks already know.
I think the floor is yours. I think you can kind of highlight those areas where there was some concerns that have been raised and how you were able to work with the police administration to kind of iron out things. I know that there was in my own department, I know that there was areas of concern. They recognized that the bill had so many great qualities to it. There was some recent meetings that happened, transpired, where I believe that you were able to come to concessions that with small tweaks of language that there would be consensus and support across departments, not only the police departments, but also the general public to be supportive of those changes. So let me
start by saying I certainly appreciate that, and I hope that as folks have had time since June, they have recognized a lot of the really good things in a very lengthy bill. I mean, this is a 70-something page bill with 40-something sections to it. I believe, and I think a lot of my majority of my legislative colleagues believe, really responded to the moment that we're living in and the call for change we've heard in communities throughout Connecticut. This is a bill that hopefully encourages more minority recruitment of police officers. It encourages departments to be creative in how to respond to certain situations that are not, that police officers may not be the best equipped to deal with. It hopefully gives you as elected officials some better coverage to require pure, you know, in your union negotiations and others, in other places, periodic drug testing and mental health screening of your officers. One of the things I certainly heard loud and clear from many police chiefs and mayors and first selectmen I talked to is we needed to make it easier to fire or get rid of the bad police officer, which we think we've accomplished through this bill. You know, we've allowed additional civilian oversight of police departments and citizen engagement, which I think is critically important. We've provided additional funding to those communities who don't yet have dashboard or body cameras. We want every community in the state to have those, and we've appropriated an additional $4 million to incentivize communities to go out and make that purchase. You know, we've banned chokeholds. We've required officers to intervene and report when they observe excess force. We've created an independent office of the Inspector General, which hopefully will provide, and I know there's been some instances where in communities where folks question the impartiality of the state's attorney, and hopefully this will alleviate that. And then when there is an investigation and ultimately an outcome in an investigation, even where that outcome is an officer is not going to be prosecuted for using excess force, that there's better community trust buy-in with that decision based on the independent Inspector General. So with that, let me focus in on a couple of the areas that certainly I've heard kind of the most concern about. First, before we move past the Inspector General piece, as folks may have read, we had an unintended consequence where the Criminal Justice Commission, which is the board who appoints the Inspector General, deadlocked. They had two candidates and they deadlocked 3-3 on their decision. We need to make a change in the way the Inspector General is appointed in order to deal with that situation and actually get that office off the ground. So that will be one change. Certainly we'll see us push come January. Some of the other areas where certainly I heard the most concern from folks some police departments took issue with the ban on consent searches. And this is the notion of where somebody is pulled over for rolling through a stop sign or speeding, and the officer approaches the car and they just stopped him for a traffic stop. And they say, well, you know, while I got you pulled over, you don't mind if I just look around in the back of your car, you don't mind if I look in your trunk, do you? And of course, constitutionally, you have no obligation to allow a police officer to do that. But it happens in the statistics, both in Connecticut or nationally, unsurprisingly maybe, are the folks who are subjected to consent searches way more often than not are young African-American males as opposed to middle-aged white guys. So as we respond to this call for a reset of the paradigm and responding to the call for racial justice and change, I think that's one of the areas where there may have been some controversy about that, but I don't see us going backwards on that. We tried to put in place a fairly nuanced limit on consent searches. What we did in this bill is a lot less draconian than the law is in Rhode Island, for example, in this area. And I don't see that as being an area that certainly I'm not willing to go back and revisit. Where I think you could see us look at things again are on the use of force policy. When we modified the use, what is justifiable use of deadly force in this bill, we were trying to get to the national standard. Actually, the Model Penal Code national standard on use of force was a more restrictive standard than what Connecticut had. It's an area where Connecticut law was not as progressive as kind of the national model was. And we tried to move to the national standard. The language we used, are there places it could possibly be clearer? that it could be tweaked? Do we need to give officers some additional time and police departments time to train up their officers on what the new standard is? Possibly. And we were waiting on a report from the Post Council, which just came out. Actually, I don't think it's publicly out yet. It is just about to come out, kind of on the training standard and how our training would work in Connecticut under the new standard. And there's a couple of areas I think they're going to recommend that we tweak the language and give it a little additional time to departments to get up to speed on that. I'm certainly open to that. I in fact want to make that change. I think it's necessary. This has never been a try to be a game of gotcha for police departments or police officers. It's how do we step things up a notch? How do we make sure that our standard really is where it should be? And let's make sure we get the training folks need. One of the other areas I know I've heard from towns a lot on is this certification requirement that's 3 or 4 years out and what the cost of that will be. And I know, you know, there's a couple different certifying agencies. I'm certainly amenable to expanding who those would be. I think there's another kind of more Connecticut focused certification board. I would like to see us make that change. I don't think this was ever about kind of one particular agency doing the certifying, but you know, it's about, again, increasing the minimum standard of police departments across the state. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the qualified immunity provision of this bill early on. Obviously, the very first version of this bill would have eliminated qualified immunity altogether. The final version of the bill, in my estimation, if you cut through the political rhetoric, really provides a very limited civil cause of action where an individual's civil rights are violated and the officer did not have a good faith belief they're complying with the law when they did it. You know, I don't know what the debate or discussion on that provision will end up playing out with. I certainly think we struck the right balance between protecting officers who are trying to comply with the law and are acting in good faith, as opposed to those instances where a victim cannot get a redress or compensation where their constitutional rights have been clearly violated. We're trying to draw that line. My personal belief, and I'm sure there's folks on this call who would disagree with me, but my personal belief is we did draw that right line. You know, I'm a civil litigation attorney by as a day job. This is what I do. This type of work. I actually am town council for a small town in Connecticut. I don't think this is going to change the state of the law that dramatically for towns. There may be a few additional cases, but I don't think you're going to see a flood of litigation as a result. But time will tell on that. And with that, I guess, Madam Mayor, Madam Chair, I guess I would take any questions or highlight anything that folks think I missed.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve. Do I have any questions for Representative Stastrom in regards to it? Yes. So, Scott, why don't you go right ahead?
Thank you. Just really quickly, on the Inspector General, are they looking at just changing the process by which the Inspector General is chosen, or are they also looking at changing the pool of applicants? Because it's really the same people that currently conduct the investigations now. And the choices are white male or white male. And I think that is, I'm not sure that that's a very good idea given the nature of the challenges that law enforcement faces, especially with respect to how the public views it. So I'm wondering if they're also looking at the pool as opposed to just the process.
Yeah, I think we will. I think what we wanted to make clear is obviously the person who is appointed for that job has to become a certified prosecutor. And some of this, without getting too deep into the weeds, is kind of the way the Constitution is structured in the state of Connecticut, that all prosecutorial authority in the state has to fall under the auspices of the Division of Criminal Justice. So even if you're going to bring somebody in from the outside, you have to hire them into the Division of Criminal Justice. They have to be certified as a prosecutor, and then that prosecutor can be chosen. When we drafted this bill, I think the Criminal Justice Commission could have done that. They could have gone out and hired somebody for a deputy state's attorney position someplace and then promoted them at the same time into the inspector general role. They read it slightly different than I do and would like it to be clearer that they can bring in somebody from the outside from the get-go. So I think we probably will make that change. I was actually on a call with it.
That's a helpful explanation. Thank you very much.
Yes, Jason, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Stastrom, it's nice to see you, and thank you for taking the time to join us today. I appreciated your comments on police officer certification. The concern that I've had raised by my municipal police department is the accreditation piece, which, as you know, in Section 44 requires CALEA certification. That is a private company that is more expensive than post-C certification. My community has been now 2 years into the accreditation process through post-C, which is effectively time wasted now if that language stands as it is. So we're hoping that that can be revisited as well.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to. I apologize. I said certification, not accreditation, but I meant police department accreditation and expanding the eligibility of what qualifies as being accredited. Certification will still be, for an individual officer, will still be through post.
Anyone else have any questions? Discussion? So, there was a discussion in response to, I'll say, what the word on the street was, Steve, that there was, the police were feeling like there was going to be a sense that they were going to hesitate on how they would respond in a very sensitive and immediate response situation where they needed to draw their guns. It's my understanding that maybe it was a lot in the bill prior to it being fully digested and time lagging for people to process it. But there still seems to be that underlying with the rank and file, and certainly not with the administration, that there is a trade-off for police safety when they're responding to a critical incident where split seconds matter. In their response. I don't know how you read that interpretation by some of our rank and file as opposed to the bill, how you weigh that.
I think that's exceptionally unfortunate that folks still have that belief. I mean, I've heard it too. I think unfortunately this bill became way too politicized after its passage. It became an election year fodder. I get them in mixed company here, but it became election year fodder, quite frankly, and it became folks tried to use it as a political wedge issue in the November election. And I think there's still some unfortunate misinformation floating around as a result of it. So I do think it's incumbent on me and others to try to explain what this bill actually does and doesn't do. I do, as I said before, I think the use of force language in this bill, while it moves us towards the national model, there are places where the language I think is clear, but I could see where folks would think it could be clearer. And that's why I'm willing to entertain tweaks. We were waiting for post to come out with their kind of training protocol as a result of the new use of force standard. I think once that is publicly out and digested, it will alleviate some additional concern. And I think if we can provide some additional time for training, right now the new use of force policy, don't forget, doesn't take effect until April 1st of 2021. So the same use of force policy is still in place today as it was, you know, a year ago, 6 years ago. I think we want to make sure, and we want to support officers in getting the training they need in order to comply with the policy, as opposed to, again, some sort of game factor that's never been the intent of this. And I think, you know, yes, old habits do die hard. Are we asking officers to change the way they've done certain things? And maybe in a way, but I think with the right training, we can achieve the goal.
You know, one other question. Thank you for that. There was one other question. I was wondering if you had anticipated to do an annual review of this bill or over a period of time to ensure that you really are capturing everything that wants to be addressed in this, or if there are areas that need to be changed or areas that need to be kind of rewritten.
Yeah, so I don't forget, the Police Accountability and Transparency Task Force continues to meet. They're gonna have some recommendations with respect to this. I've had regular meetings with the Police Chiefs Association, and particularly with Chief Melanson, and also with Chief Mello from Milford, who's the chair of POST. I think, you know, oftentimes when we do major legislation, we tweak it every couple of years, and sometimes it doesn't quite get the, you know, the media attention the original bill did, and the cycle moves on. But particularly when it comes to the big stuff that comes through the Judiciary Committee, we often are going back 2, 3, 4, 5 years in a row, making tweaks based on issues that come up. You know, we change the penal code every year in some way, shape, or form. So there will absolutely, I'm sure, be additional modifications to this as time goes on.
Another question that I had was in regards to civilian oversight. There was some discussion whether they would be set up regionally or whether each community would be required to set their own. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on where that was going, or if there was any thought on doing it on a regional or county level.
So right now it's permissive. I don't see any reason you couldn't have a civilian review board that operate on a regional basis, but I think that would predominantly work if you had a regional police force, which I'm not sure anybody in Connecticut really does. I would say unfortunately, but I think the way it's sort of structured right now, or the intent was that, you know, the town of East Hartford, if they wanted to have a civilian review board to review incidents or complaints against officers who work for the East Hartford Police Department, that would be the place to go.
I know that there had been some discussions out there. We felt that I know in our town, we felt every department was managed differently, and that it would be unique to our communities how we would handle it.
I think the one place we really thought in this bill regionalization would be helpful is we've seen in certain, particularly some of the larger cities, Waterbury in particular, where they've started using some social workers kind of in connection with police officers. So if you've got a domestic violence situation, the police officer may go in and make sure the situation is calm enough, and then the social worker goes in and is the one that says, all right, what really happened here? What's going on? What's the underlying issue? Or a situation where somebody is threatening to kill themselves, the police officer goes in and maybe stabilizes the situation, takes the gun, but isn't really trained to be the one to say, okay, what's really going on here? What are the services you need? The like. And I get that we're a smaller town, kind of having a social worker employed in each shift may be a cost burden. So we didn't mandate in this bill, but what we did encourage, and we do want to encourage towns to think about, is maybe if, you know, the COG gets together and there is a social worker or two who's employed and at the disposal as kind of a mutual aid type of arrangement with each police department, that they can call somebody in on very short notice to help in those types of situations. It would improve policing throughout the state and also, I think, help many of our police departments do their job more effectively by not having to be, you know, the Swiss Army knife all the time.
Lyle, I know you had your hand up there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, while we have you on the call, I wondered if you wanted to offer any general comments about the upcoming session in terms of, you know, what you see as priorities and how it might proceed. If that's okay, Madam Chair, I just wanted to, since we had Representative Sassman here, we could ask him for input.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of waiting to see. I don't think any of us think it's going to be the same session we've been used to in terms of the sheer number of bills, and certainly the legislative office building is not going to be open to the public or to any of you to come testify in the way that it has been in the past. I think the building will be restricted to legislators and kind of key staff. Public hearings are going to be via Zoom, which, you know, the Judiciary Committee has done a couple of things, so we're kind of used to it, but I think some of the other committees, there'll be some growing pains as they get used to it. I think, you know, certainly, you know, it is a budget year, so the budget will obviously predominate much of this, and also sort of what we do with the governor's executive orders on COVID. You know, is there stuff that gets confirmed? Do we extend certain deadlines out? Are there ways in which we've realized we can do business codified moving forward? For example, the Judiciary Committee, you know, we have cognizance over the court system. Well, the court system has gone remote in many respects, and you know, they're doing oaths online and hearings online and the like. And frankly, there's some of that stuff that is probably more accessible to the public. It's cheaper for the litigants. It's easier. It allows us maybe not to have the same number of court facilities long-term that we have to maintain and pay for right now. So do we codify the way we are currently doing business in some respects into law moving forward? And I think those will be the types of issues you're going to see a lot of come the legislative session.
Well, thank you very much.
Any other questions for Representative Stastrom? It's not a very lively group here. We appreciate you taking the time and really kind of talking to us. That the discussion came up early, and we were glad that you had the opportunity to come on board and kind of just share some thoughts in regards to, which is really like very powerful legislation that was enacted. So thanks for continuing to represent Connecticut and doing the work that you're doing and chairing the committee. You know, it's not easy when you put in play significant legislation, but we appreciate your efforts and all the work that you've done towards it.
Well, thanks for having me, and thank you to all of you for all you do for our towns. Good luck with, on top of all the COVID response you're all doing, good luck plowing the streets tomorrow. So the nice thing about being a legislator on a day like tomorrow is, you know, we get to lay in bed and maybe go build a snowman with our kids. You guys have to make sure the streets get
plowed. I was thinking possibly a new legislative item could be that all representatives need to get their CDL, so when our public works people are not able to come out, we can call on an immediate task of all representatives.
Sounds like a good idea to me. I would love to drive one of those big trucks around for the day. So I'm not sure the city of Bridgeport could handle the property damage I would get. You know, beyond that. Take care,
great.
Everybody.
Thanks so much. Be well. Kathy, you want to give us an update?
I don't know as I have anything other to add than Representative did. Interesting that he's saying still, you know, so much is still in flux. But that's clearly the, that is clearly the issue. So a couple of weeks in, it'll all, they'll still be ironing it out. Everybody is playing it by ear. Oh, I would like to just say, if I can get the list with the email.
You're breaking up, Kathy.
Yeah, Kathy, you're breaking up.
Addresses to them.
Kathy,
If you turn off your video, we could probably hear you better.
I'm sorry. Are you able to hear me?
Yeah, a little better. Go right ahead, Kath.
Sorry.
Kathy, if you turn off your video, we could probably hear you better. There we
go. Is that any better?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay. If I can get the list with email addresses of the legislative committee, so we can tailor all that information that's as it's happening, I'd appreciate it.
Right.
Other than that, I don't have anything else.
Okay, John, I know you had your hand raised.
Thank you very much. I just want to give a heads up. A couple weeks ago, we got a letter from Martin Heft saying that there's going to be another round of CARES Act money of what appeared to be the balance of the $75 million they set aside for towns that we didn't spend. And they're going to allocate it on a per capita basis. Since then, it's been dead silent. I've been trying to track it because the deadline for encumbered purchase orders is December 31st. And we all have Christmas breaks and snowstorms to deal with. But my estimate, and I could be way off on this, is that the per capita money that you will be getting is somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 per capita. So a boatload of money that you'll need to figure out how to spend by December 31st. But the most important thing is they're going to announce the actual details tonight at the governor's call, which has now been moved to 5:30 tonight. So I know that's something that a lot of you have assigned to staff, but I think you need to pay attention to this because it's a lot of money. For our town, if it's that $8 or so, that's $100,000 that we would have to encumber by December 31st.
So, John, I do have a little bit of information on that only from speaking with Martin Heff, and I didn't hear the $8. I heard there was a formula, and they didn't tell me what the per capita.
I've worked out that formula.
Oh, well, I trust what you do, so I'm, I'll take it.
I think the real numbers will come out, and that's basically, there was $35 million. I think that they spent about... We spent about $45 million, so there's about $30 million.
There was a significant amount of money left over, yes. Yeah.
So you take that divided by the state population. It's in that range. But just to give you an order of magnitude, for like Hartford and some other large areas, it's a boatload of money and very little time.
So when I talked to Martin in regards to that, and he kind of gave me a ballpark of what I could expect in East Hartford, he had anticipated that it would have been out before this, knowing that the end of the year was looming. He said on Monday when I texted him saying, "Where's the money?" He said that he was waiting for approval and release by the secretary. Yeah. And that he was having a meeting with her today, and he was hoping he'd have more information. That was Monday. I didn't get anything else back from him.
So my inside information is that they're announcing it at the governor's call tonight.
Okay, that's good.
So I've just given a heads up, and I mentioned to Lyle that, and I've mentioned it to CCM also, that there are some programs that may be CRF eligible that we're offering, some of the software programs and the like, that if either organization or both organizations came up with a shopping list, that you could quickly say, check, I want that. But there are also some changes of things that were denied originally. And again, this is all my investigation and therefore it may not be true. So I caution you, but they're going to change some definitions like police overtime, because we had budgeted police overtime or fire overtime or ambulance overtime, was not deemed to be CRF eligible. They're going to change the definition of that and say, because of COVID, that if you spend a lot of money on overtime, it may now be eligible. So there are some simple things that you can recoup money that was denied before. Obviously, your 25% FEMA match, if you didn't get that in, that can count. Or if you had supplemental FEMA, that can count. So there's a whole shopping list of things. I've been with you trying to nudge and got the same answers. It's on somebody's desk. But it's going to be shocking to a lot of people that if it's the governor's announcement tonight, snowstorm tomorrow, that maybe Friday, maybe Monday, you'll get some notice and have a couple days to put together an action plan. And we want this money spent wisely. So I just a heads up.
Madam Chair, John, do you happen to have the link for the governor's call today? I got a call from a request from a board member here in terms of what that was.
Hold
maybe it's in the chat from Chris McCardle.
I can forward it to you, Lyle.
It's a dial-in phone number.
Yeah.
It's 1-888-455-0572. And the passcode is 102-5007 hashtag. But I can't forward it to people because it says do not forward. I'm a rule follower.
I was just going to say, are you supposed to be revealing this?
John, I think it's 507, not 5,000, correct?
Oh, you're right. Well, 5007, hashtag.
So just out of curiosity.
1025007, hashtag.
Just getting back to the formula, the dollar amount that I was told we were getting does not... does not equate to the $8 per capita.
Okay, I could be well off.
So ours is more. So
well, it would be per capita. You know, if you got, that's more than I got. I had to like come up with my number. If you got a per capita based on East Hartford, that would be the same per capita across the state. So I don't know how much it was.
So, can't tell you because I don't want the rug pulled out from under me when all of a sudden they say, oh, well, we decided not to give you that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the original, and they may change that per capita idea too. Who knows what they've been doing?
There was actually what I was told was that by Martin was that there was two formulas, and the numbers were pretty similar either way for all the communities that they were running in.
Okay.
So, and other than that, no other details other than what you had that we could backslide this money into. Already spent allocations to fulfill those, and seeing that FEMA pretty much rejected everyone's expenses that were submitted. That
I only lost $3,000 to FEMA.
John, could you give
that number? Maybe you didn't submit enough.
I'll do it in chat to everyone.
Okay, that's great. Madam Chair, so we'll listen to see what the governor has to say today, and if there's opportunities to plug in some of the resources that CROG might have access to, we'll let everybody know.
Great, and I know Chip had his hand up. I want to recognize him.
Yeah, I have a question for Kathy. Well, the legislature's in such flux, but it seems to me the governor might potentially have ideas of regulatory reform, budget impacts, electronic government processes. Are you hearing anything that's new that might be proposed as governor's bills or administration bills?
I've heard that some of the agencies are looking to streamline their processes based on how they're dealing with things now. I think at the end of the day, it's going to go back to how much time they're able to devote to however many bills it the way they have to handle it is certainly going to bog things down considerably. But we don't have the agency bills yet. We were hoping to have them, still assuming maybe by the end of the week, the agency bills will be available. So as soon as we are able to see them, we'll have a better sense of that.
Maybe if it's going to be next week, you could forward those to the legislative committee or to the bigger group so that people might be aware of what's coming down the pike.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your question.
Maybe when the agency bills come out, could you forward those to Lyle so he could distribute them and we know what was likely to be coming up?
Yes, absolutely.
Madam Chair, there is one more thing that, as you well know, as a member of ACIR and others on the call, is considering as the local government of the future, which is a proposal that's coming from ACIR to the governor's office with some of
that. You mean the one you told me not to tell anyone about, Lyle?
That's the one. But I didn't. That's the one. No, I mean, in terms of the content of the bill, it isn't out yet. But they're working on that. It's gone to the governor's office for consideration for inclusion in his budget pack or his legislative package. So we don't know where that is, but it's relevant also. And if that makes some progress, we'll certainly share that too. I just wanted to mention it without giving you the details.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a major broadband bill too.
Yep.
Any other discussions? Any other business to come before CROG? I have to get off for another meeting, but I did want to throw this out there just to the CROG members. We have in the town of East Hartford, and I know other communities are undergoing and looking for to hire different municipal employees. And the thought press passed through my head that perhaps there is an opportunity for us to do a kind of common application with a resume submission, so that if the town of East Hartford was posting for a director of finance or a assistant finance director, that we would be able to post it, and then collectively, if I did not select that person, it would go into a pool where other members within our organization, if they were looking for a particular person within that field and the resume was submitted to, that you would have easy access rather than having to go out and repost for a position where it could have been, so, you know, one of the candidates that one of us did not take that may be a good candidate. I'm just thinking to skip steps in between and redundancies. I'm wondering if there isn't an opportunity there for us to collectively work. I know the fire department started to use the common application. It's worked out really well for them. Ours could be a little bit different, but I don't want to get into I don't have the time actually get into a deep discussion about it. But right now we have several potential openings coming up, and I just didn't know where. And when I went on to the website of CCM to look at, you know, how people post jobs, the thought came to me, well, why wouldn't we just retain some of those candidates that didn't get hired as a pool to potential hiring?
Any thoughts? Yep. We do have an HR portal that could be grafted onto them. I'm just looking at Pauline here. So if there is interest, that's something we could certainly explore.
So food for thought, and I'm not asking because I have to get off the call, but if anyone wants to think about it, maybe we can bring it back up at the next meeting on how that could kind of work, or if anyone has an interest in it. So that's it. If there's no other business to come before policy board, I'll call for a motion to adjourn.
So move, Chris Kervick.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Have an amazing holiday, and I wish you all well through this snowstorm as we kind of find our way with missing public works employees during COVID. The challenge is real, so appreciate it, and best of luck to all of you.
Are you going to have firefighters plowing?
Yeah.
I'm